Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Of course, we begin our show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. You are not bored. You have it committed to memory. You understand what a patriot sounds like because that's what Vindman sounds like, and you're going to bring his voice and his assurance to his father that it will be all right into your head when you exercise the franchise in November. It will not be all right unless you vote. It'll not be all right unless you change the person who's sitting in the Oval Office. This, of course, is Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Well, if it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. And Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps, and someone who has taught me so much about Texas, I can't even stand it. We actually interviewed a county commissioner yesterday, Scott, and it was so much fun because he was saying, well, this and this, and I'm thinking, I know this, and I'm thinking, I could write a book based on what you've taught me. So I'm always grateful about my insight into both Texas politics,
just
Texas
forward
history.
Me those sweet royalties.
I will,
Arnie.
Share them.
Yeah, send me that mailbox money.
I will, I promise.
That's what I'm here for.
So you sent me a list of topics. I want to start with the last one. Just
whatever
because
you
like. I've been hearing dribs and drabs about this, and I want to know more about it. You write, a complete meltdown at the Republican Party of Texas Convention and rising from the ashes. I'm not sure it's rising. Anyway, and rising from the ashes is the party's new chairman, Alan West, the former Florida congressman with a long history of fanning the flames of the culture wars. Whoa. Talk to me a little bit about what happened at the convention, but more importantly, who's the new face of the Republican Party in Texas?
Arnie, you and I had talked a lot about this debate within the Republican Party of Texas for having an in-person convention in the middle of a global pandemic. There was a lot of concern that this would be what health experts call a super spreader event for COVID-19. There was also the health authority in Houston, which had said that this was a clear and present danger to have about 6,000 people gather in person for an indoor event. And an event where a lot of the people would be the type of activists who are against wearing a mask and doing physical distancing and all that sort of stuff. And it's not, without merit, those concerns. I mean, we've seen Tea Party events in Texas that our little governor has attended, for example, where there is no physical distancing, there are no masks, et cetera. By the way, this is Texas politics in a nutshell in 2020. Imagine being the congressman who attends a Tea Party event with Dan Patrick, and you're also someone who voted yes to get rid of Confederate monuments at the Capitol in D.C. yesterday. That was Representative Dan Crenshaw, by the way, who represents a suburban district in the Houston area. So at the convention, which ended up online after multiple lawsuits were filed against the city of Houston in state court and in federal court, the chairman, as of last week, a guy named James Dickey, decided to go ahead and take the convention online. There was a robust debate, Arnie, and it's very easy for a lot of us to just think that the conservative activists of the Republican Party, which is, that's the people who make up the Republican Party of Texas, you might just think that they all want to have an in-person convention, because what has President Trump been saying? That basically this disease is a hoax, and if you wear a mask, it's a protest of him. He only in the last week or so, has embraced wearing the mask, and he still doesn't wear it. He just says that he'll wear it, and he might tweet a picture of him wearing it. If people remember the cartoons from the 90s, some folks around here were joking that he kind of looks like Cobra Commander from G.I. Joe.
Yes.
He's fully morphed into that. But at the convention online, to say it was a meltdown, I'm understating that. There were technical glitches on Thursday of last week after you and I talked. The entire convention ground to a halt because they couldn't even get people logged into the online system to be able to vote on things like their platform and the rules for the party and the election of the chairman, vice chairman, and members of the state Republican Executive Committee. Late on Sunday night, and some have described this as a coup within the Republican Party, it was about 10 p.m. on Sunday night, and I watch all of this online so that other folks don't have to. At about 10 o'clock, the system for voting, which there was all this concern, the delegates of the Republican Party concerned that there might be some something nefarious happening with online voting, remote voting. You had delegates saying, why can't we just go back to paper ballots? Well, of course you can't at the moment that, you know, you're having an online convention with people spread out across a state of 30 million people in 254 counties. But they were having a cyber attack. The chairman said a cyber attack was happening on the voting system for the Republican Party convention. They supposedly fixed that, and they moved ahead with the convention. But and you can't make this up, Arnie. Things were going so badly that the delegates voted to postpone the platform debate and the rules debate for the Republican Party and have that later this year at a second convention. And who knows if that'll be in person or online as well. But they voted to go ahead and have the race for chairman and vice chairman on Sunday night.
They need leadership.
Well, they didn't vote.
Funny here.
They didn't vote on that until about 3 a.m. Monday morning. And some were calling it the Monday morning massacre as James Dickey was turned out overwhelmingly in favor of former Florida Congressman Alan West, who is being funded by some out-of-state folks, some people who have been mega donors to Ted Cruz, for example. Alan West, all you got to do is Google Alan, and you will find
out. I've got Alan right in front of me, so keep going. I'm watching this. I'm listening.
Google
to you.
Alan West, the new chairman of the Texas Republican Party. He's a lieutenant colonel retired from the U.S. Army. He was stripped of his command back in 2003 after pleading guilty to assaulting an Iraqi detainee during an interrogation. That from the Boston Globe. He's someone with a long history of saying things that are very controversial. He had said things that sounded anti-Semitic to a lot of people. Of course, in Florida, that's a rough thing. He's somebody who's been a prolific fundraiser, but keeps putting his foot in his mouth. If you looked at a rundown of some of the things that he said, you know, he plagiarized a viral internet story, questioned the loyalties of decorated veteran Senator Tammy Duckworth back in 2014. He has said that Islam, quote, is not a religion, and we need to have individuals stand up and say that. West, who is African-American, said, quote, the black community was stronger and had better education opportunities during segregation. That was back in 2016. His Facebook page posted an image praising General Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis, for an alleged plan to exterminate Muslims. He also called former President Obama and AG Eric Holder vile and disgusting, racist, and of course he was also one of those who called Barack Hussein Obama an Islamist. That's just a small sampling of what's ahead now.
I am so thrilled that he's now been chosen as a GB. Let me just read you one more thing he says. In light of what you are just sort of laying out, I thought this is a quote from him. There are three words I hate to hear used. Ready? I hate the words big tent. I hate inclusiveness. And I hate outreach. Oh my God. He goes, I think you stand on principles that make you great, which transcend everybody in America. And eventually people will come to it. Build it and they will come. Build racism, build segregation. Unbelievable.
The race for chairman really heated up over the last year as West and Dickey participated in debates or forums all across the great state. I attended one in San Antonio, and the headline from the story that I wrote was, in the race to lead the Texas GOP, Chairman Dickey promotes building party infrastructure, while the challenger, Alan West, focuses on his life story. Arnie, this was at this was in San Antonio in front of a group of Hispanic Republicans. His message, West's message for the largely Hispanic crowd, was that the abortionists in this country have already claimed the lives of millions of African-American babies, and he was there to say to the Hispanics that the abortionists are coming for your babies too. Of course, this is the kind of thing that gets the feet stomping and gets Republican activists to cheer and applaud. Here's something that is an internal debate in both parties, by the way, not issue specific, but you do have those who really rile up the base of the party by, you know, playing to their passions about various issues. And then you'll have candidates who probably agree with those people on the issues, but they stress the party infrastructure. And this is what Chairman Dickey was trying to do. He was talking about raising millions of dollars to try to elect Republicans, about field operations, and about all of the, what some people might consider, boring mechanics of running the party. But what he's stressing is that the role,
that's the role of the chairman. Am I correct?
The role of the chairman is to elect as many Republicans as possible. On the Democratic side, it would be to elect Democrats, right?
Right.
And to backstop candidates. In Texas, it's long been, and in other places, it's similar. In Texas, the candidates run their races, and the parties are there to try to backstop them, right? To make sure that they have access to data that they need, to polling that they need, to money if they need that, and all that sort of stuff. And in the meantime, in individual communities, you would have candidates figuring out what the people in their area. In Texas, it would be people in the suburbs in Dallas-Fort Worth, or people in inner city Houston, trying to figure out what kind of messages, what issues resonate and matter to the voters in those areas. Right. And then you'd have the political parties backstop them with money, data, resources, mm-hmm. et cetera. But you do see this, and I think this is happening all across the country. I know it's happened here, where with base voters, they lose a sense of place. And this especially happens in suburban Texas. You have a lot of people who just got there, they just moved there within the last year or the last 2 years or the last 5 years. All these folks were moving to Texas from all these different places. Even during the pandemic, Arnie, it's still the case that about 1,000 people move to Texas every day. Is that amazing? We still have this magnet for people coming to Texas, because we do have jobs here for people that they, are suffering in some other parts of the country. Former Governor Perry always liked to brag about the fact that if you wanted to rent a U-Haul and go from Texas to California, it cost less than if you rented one in California to come to Texas, because the demand to get a U-Haul to come to Texas is more. All these people who are constantly moving here, they don't really know what that place was like before. Exactly. It's exactly the way it was when they got there. So they don't know anything about that place, really, and they don't know who made the decisions and who did the work to make it what it is now. And so this leads to a kind of politics where you don't have to speak as much to what's important to those individualized communities. What you really just need to do to be able to sort of unlock the lock, put the key in the lock, is just be able to talk about all these national messages. Alan West is somebody who is on Fox News Channel all the time. He has run some national organizations and has been involved in national politics. So while you have a chairman like Dickey who was trying to talk about what it takes to win in these individual parts of Texas, that really doesn't matter to the voters or the delegates at the Republican Party of Texas. What they want to hear is that you're going to back up President Trump, that you're anti-abortion and all of these other things, which, again, on the issues, they probably agree on almost everything. But it's a matter of emphasis and it's a matter of style. I mean, the kinds of things that Alan West is saying are the kinds of things that President Trump and his supporters say all the time.
Well, and so I'm looking at another article about Alan. And again, you kind of want someone who sort of exercises leadership, will exercise fiduciary responsibility, will make sure that the dollars go in the right direction, has sort of a history of being able to do this. And one of the things I realized came out during this fight was where we're talking about him moving to Texas. Like, why did he come? He moved to North Texas after being named CEO of the Dallas-based National Center for Policy Analysis.
Yeah, which
went bankrupt. Right. The center showed it 3 years later, a development that came up in his run for party chair. Yeah. The think tank's board had ousted the founder in 2014. And under West's leadership, it hired a finance director who was ultimately accused of embezzling hundreds of thousands of dollars. Wow. Maybe he should have vetted that guy before he hired him. But this happened under his watch.
That just didn't matter. In the race for chairman, Chairman Dickey had said that he would stress this to delegates at these various events, forums that the two guys would speak at. He had said that he'd been sounding the alarm with Republican donors, the big money guys, for more than a year, telling them that Democrats are ascendant in Texas, and those concerns were not taken seriously. The quote from Dickey at the time was, "When I would say a year and a half ago, any of this stuff, I would get dismissed. But after November of 2018, when Democrats made historic gains in the Texas legislature and picked up two seats in Congress on the coattails of Beto O'Rourke," Dickey said he had a very different reaction. He got a different reaction from those contributors, and they were stepping up with resources to the tune of millions of dollars to try to beat back this blue wave, if you want to call it that. But West said, quote, "It does not matter how much money you have if you have a crappy message." Unquote.
On that note, I think I'm so glad that Alan West has been chosen as GOP chairman. Well, he has the poster child for almost, in a way, he's every caricature that the Democrats have of the Republican Party. And now that caricature is now the chairman of the Texas GOP. And he says it all. He admits he doesn't want to be inclusive. He admits that he doesn't want to do outreach. He doesn't like the sort of the day-to-day operations of what a GOP chairman should do. He doesn't believe that that's really what is going to bring the base out. Well, he may be right. Now the question is, what about those people that are sort of still looking for some kind of leadership and support in order to defeat Democrats in the fall? They may not be getting it from his leadership.
No, they won't. And there's already been talk among Republican office holders that what they're going to have to do is work with some other organizations, including a group called the Associated Republicans of Texas, which has been around for a long time. And it has been in the past when we have had chairman like in, you know, in this mold before, Arnie, Republican donors, business guys, folks like that would run their money through this other group, the Associated Republicans of Texas, instead of the party, because they felt that was a better way to get resources to candidates who need it.
All right, before we change topics, I just want to ask one quick question, though. So we know that we have Donald Trump, that you can sort of morph every Republican into sounding like, but now you have Alan West as the GOP chairman of Texas. So now you've got two choices as to who you want to have every Republican sound like. And in some ways, Alan West goes farther than Trump on a number of issues. The timing of this, especially because there's such great concern, given the polling numbers where Biden is either in a dead heat with Donald Trump, could possibly even defeat Donald Trump, which is just a shocking thought. This is the worst time for this kind of GOP chairman, but to a large extent, it's the gift that keeps on giving, because the Democrats now have another opportunity to use the chairman against his own party.
Democrats were having fun with this. One other thing I'll say about it is, as the race was playing out during the online convention this weekend, the Texas Democratic Party issued a news release in which they endorsed James Dickey for re-election as Republican Party chairman, obviously to hurt his chances. And you did have conservative activists and some of the professional grifters, including the folks at Empower Texans, come out and say, look, James Dickey is the preferred candidate of the Democrats, sort of cementing exactly what they think about Republican delegates and how stupid they think that they are.
Right. Yanking their chain. The Democrats did a brilliant job. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. I mean, it's so obvious, you know, and yet they fall right into it.
It's just shocking.
It's just shocking. All right. So we have to talk about COVID. And so I keep hearing doctors, and I'm hearing nurses from Houston and El Paso. And I'm terrified. And let me just say why I'm terrified. It's not just the numbers are so huge. It's not just that, you know, do we have enough ICU beds? How many doctors can you burn out? How many nurses can you burn out? How many people will end up either getting ill or just basically walking away because they can't emotionally hold on anymore? And it's not just about the community at large. It's about the place you go to figure out whether you can sort of save someone's life. And this isn't just, remember, people still get sick. People still get cancer. People are still in car accidents. There's still a million reasons to go to the doctor or to go to a hospital, but all those are being pushed to the back of the bus because COVID is eating all of the resources. Mm-hmm. And yet you see these people, and I'm just telling you right now, if the only reason why you care about COVID-19 is to protect these vulnerable healthcare workers that right now are totally being bludgeoned, especially in places like Texas.
Especially in Texas, especially in the Rio Grande Valley right now. It is the epicenter of this. In the valley, state health officials say that, and this was the report as of last night, 37 ICU beds are available. Hidalgo County, which is down in the Brownsville area, that is really the epicenter right now. The Hidalgo County Judge Richard Cortez told CBS News that unfortunately our hospital rooms look like war zones because there are just so many from so many sick people there. He also said that he was issuing his own shelter-at-home order on Monday. This was late on Monday, and we had heard some rumblings about this over the weekend that some local officials were going to start stepping out there, even though the governor has said that their ability and their authority to issue such orders has been undercut by his orders. He says that his Abbott has said that his orders supersede
transcend
theirs. I can tell you that politically, the governor has cover right now to just step back and let the local officials do what they feel like they need to do. There was a poll out yesterday from Quinnipiac, which we'll get into a little bit more here if you like, but one of the findings in it was that overwhelmingly Texans support local control when it comes to this issue. Let me give you these numbers, Arnie.
Unbelievable.
Texans, by a huge margin, 53% said that Abbott should not issue a stay-at-home order. That's a smaller percentage, but 68, almost 70%, 70% agree that if mayors and county judges feel it is appropriate for their communities, then Abbott should not impede them, leave them alone. Now, the numbers as of yesterday, and of course we're taping here on Thursday, so these are numbers from late Wednesday, so these would be the Thursday numbers really. Texas set a new record for reported deaths in a day from COVID-19, 197 people since Tuesday had passed away from the disease. The state now has lost about 4,300 people to COVID. That's 916 people in 7 days, more deaths than we saw all of June. We're almost at 2,000 this month. The 7-day average is 9,800 positive tests per day, 131 deaths per day, 10,000 per day in the hospital for COVID-19. That from my friend Jeremy Wallace, reporter at the Houston Chronicle.
I mentioned it yesterday. I don't have the numbers right in front of me. The Texas Department of Health was showing the exponential growth of COVID. And it was just, it's just shocking. You know, talking about like, you know, it took them 52 days to get to 1,000 a day. And then, you know, how many days it will take till we get to like 5,000 a day. And the numbers keep getting smaller and smaller because the exponential number of people who are getting COVID is expanding so rapidly. So you also mentioned that, is this the first time ever that Governor Abbott is below 50% in approval rating too, when you were talking about the polls that are coming in?
There have been a couple of polls now that show that what was interesting is you now have consistent numbers showing that Governor Abbott is under 50%.
Wow.
Both for coronavirus response and in his overall job approval. The latest poll on this was from Quinnipiac, came out on Wednesday, and this was what the pollster said. Abbott is handling the response to the coronavirus, 47% approving, 48% disapproving, which, Arnie, is a 21-point net swing in approval from early June, when 56% of voters approved and 36% disapproved. And here's the thing that's changing on this, and it's really an amazing thing if you think about the fact that people really have to have some personal experience with this to have it matter.
Yes.
You know, and when they get asked about it, you ask the question in the poll, do you personally know anyone who has been diagnosed with the coronavirus? In June, this was June 3rd, only 35% said that they knew somebody personally who had been diagnosed with it. 64% said no. Fast forward to July 22nd, which is just yesterday, the numbers had flipped. 66% say that they do know somebody who has the coronavirus. And so this is changing their perceptions of everything. And they're starting to see what the real, you know, what the realities are of this. One other thing we should say about what's happening down in the valley. There were reports that when people are showing up to the hospital in the valley, they're screening them for their probability of being able to be saved, their survivability. If it looks like they're just not savable, they're sending them home.
We heard stories like that in New York, but New York has now been able to really sort of take control of this disease. I don't know how long it will last, but right now they're doing incredibly well. So before I let you go, I just want to play one more thing, because in a lot of ways, Governor Abbott has a lot of cover now because Donald Trump is changing his position. This is the headline from the Vanity Fair article. Trump voters are old and they don't want to die. Why Trump finally flip-flopped on mask wearing. And I wrote, I've been saying this for months. When you are killing your base, you may need to adjust your message. They didn't retire to places like Florida just to die prematurely because their president is in COVID denial. So in a lot of ways, whatever Donald Trump was doing vis-a-vis COVID wasn't working. His base is now dying. You're looking at the governors like Governor Abbott, a lot of Republican governors who are now having to walk away from the president. And to a large extent, that's why they have to do what they have to do.
Your friend and mine, Dave Carney, the chief political strategist for Governor Abbott, told the New York Times on Sunday that they, in the Abbott administration, they run all their requests by Vice President Pence because the president, quote, got bored with the pandemic. That's remarkable, Arnie. First of all, Dave Carney doesn't get quoted in a lot of places. So that what that tells me, there's a reason they had Carney say that to the New York Times, that there's a reason the campaign had him say that. It's sort of a trial balloon for how that's going to go over with people, that the governor of Texas, the governor of the biggest Republican state, is saying through his strategist that President Trump is checked out on this, right? So they're distancing themselves. Meantime, you have Governor Abbott's response to the disease not getting a good review from voters in these polls. And so this is what I was thinking about a lot, and I know you've got to run here in just a second, but final thought, Governor Abbott distancing himself from President Trump, with the governor's approval ratings dropping like a rock, a 20-point swing over a month, you have to believe that Republicans who are on the ballot, reminder for the listeners, Abbott's not on the ballot. Mm-hmm. Republicans who are on the ballot will probably also try to distance themselves similarly from Abbott. And if the whole idea of getting rid of straight ticket voting in Texas was that every candidate would have to run on their own merits and make their own arguments and not run as a team, we're going to test that theory in 2020.
On that note, you're so edifying. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. And we're going to be following this right through this November election. It's going to be a wild election. Now the question,
Buckle up, Arnie.
Are they going to trust the results? Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. Ciao.
Thanks, Arnie. Talk soon.
All right. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and, of course, producers Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. Stick around.
Are you rain ready? On this current cast. Many people in the Great Lakes region have experienced the misfortune of finding water in the basement during heavy rain. Now a free online tool called My Rain Ready can help homeowners assess and address their flood risk. Marcella Bondi Keenan of the Chicago-based Center for Neighborhood Technology says users answer questions about their home and landscaping. The tool estimates their flood risk and provides custom recommendations.
So things as simple as making sure their gutters are clear and making sure that the street sewer grates are cleared.
Or more advanced actions, such as replacing a concrete patio with a garden that will absorb stormwater and help make a home more rain ready. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Southern leaves, southern trees we hung from. Barren souls, heroic songs unsung. Forgive them, Father, they know this knot is undone. Tied with the rope that my grandmother died. Pride of the pilgrims, affect lives of millions. In slave days, separating fathers from children. Institution ain't just a building, but a method of having black and brown bodies fill them. We ain't seen as human beings with feelings. Will the U.S. ever be us, Lord willing? For now we know the new Jim Crow, the stop, search, and arrest our souls. Police and policies patrol, philosophies of control. A cruel hand taking hold. We let go to free them so we can free us. America's moment to come to Jesus. Caged bird sings for freedom to ring. Black bodies being lost in the American dream. Blood a black bean, a pastoral scene. Slavery still alive, check Amendment 13. Not whips and chains, our subliminal. Instead of they use the word criminal. Sweet land of liberty, incarcerated country. Shot me with your ray gun and now you wanna trump me. Prison is a business, America's the company. Investing in the justice, fear and long suffering. We staring in the face of hate again. The same hate they say will make America great again. No consolation prize for the dehumanized. For America to rise, it's a matter of black lives. And we gon' free them so we can free us. America's moment to come to Jesus.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Every other week, he joins us, Bill Curry. Bill Curry is a writer. He is a political activist. He ran for the governor of the great state of Connecticut. He was an advisor to Bill Clinton, and he's one of our favorite go-to people when it comes to trying to sort of dissect what the H is going on politically in America today. And Bill, when I reached out to you this morning, I said, you know, where do you want to begin? And there have been so many interesting sort of dynamics going on with Donald Trump, whether it is Donald Trump's comments about Jeffrey Epstein's associate, whether it's what's happening with the secret police in Portland now being sent out to other Democratic cities around the country, whether it's his shifting position on masks, because he's now started up his new press conferences. And I said, oh, finally, the return of Dr. Trump. So, this is just an amazing sort of morass that we're looking at. But as soon as I mentioned that to you, your reaction was, well, the media is doing such a terrible job of sort of covering this and explaining this. So since you're going to critique the media, I want you to flesh out that critique for my radio audience. Welcome to the program, Bill Curry.
Great to be with you as always. You know, well, I'm just, like so many of us, I'm just watching the Trump trying to reconstruct himself, to put himself more in the political mainstream regarding COVID in particular, and to rein in his natural personality by reading in that awful monotone of his from a teleprompter. Do you remember how often he used to make fun of Obama for reading from a teleprompter? The only difference between them being that Obama did it really well. But I'm just watching all this unfold, and I just remain absolutely stunned at the inability of the White House press corps and the mainstream media in general to cover this man in appropriate ways. I said on the show a few weeks back that Trump remains the hope diamond of shiny objects for the press. They can't resist him. The other thing about it, though, and that remains true, but they also just can't hold him accountable.
Exactly.
They just don't know how to do it. Watching Trump make this one baldly political lurch to something like the center in tone alone in his presentations on the virus this week, and watching, you know, the papers I read, the Washington Post, the New York Times, treating it as if it were an actual centrist move. When Trump tweeted, by the way, his first tweet about the masks, the New York Times read, Trump calls mask wearing patriotic. Well, he didn't. He said many people call it patriotic, and then he called himself patriotic, not wearing masks. That was as far as he could take it. On the second day, I think it was the Ghislaine Maxwell exchange, when one enterprising reporter from the New York Post asked him about Ghislaine Maxwell, and out of the blue, Ghislaine Maxwell being the woman who's now in prison for facilitating sex trafficking of minors on a massive, decades-long basis for the late lamented Jeffrey Epstein. And Trump twice wished her well, talked mm-hmm. about her fondly, and said that he'd met her.
In Palm Beach, they hung out together.
Not just a few times, but I noticed numerous
yes.
times. So you're sitting waiting for the follow-up to that, and there's crickets. There's nothing. and they just move on. It takes them a couple of days to realize. And we know whenever Trump talks about anybody in criminal trouble, it's with an eye to his own potential liability. He says someone's wonderful if they're lying on his behalf and horrible if they're telling the truth in a way he finds detrimental. And for him to volunteer that about Ghislaine Maxwell, I bet my eye teeth that he knows already that there's a tremendous likelihood that there will be evidence coming forth of her many, many encounters with him, and that none of them, at the very least, will be flattering, and that this was a, you know, a prophylactic measure, something he otherwise isn't into, but the, you know, the, but that he's trying to get ahead of the game here, and say, oh well, I said that, you know, I mean, it was just out of the blue.
But it was more than that. I mean, the fact that he said many times.
Yes, numerous.
Numerous times. This was kind of like an atomic bomb. And right. You would have thought the media said, really? Yeah. So let's talk about those many, yeah, numerous
that's right.
times.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
right. Nobody followed up.
Mr. President, would that be like 100? Exactly. Would that be 100 times?
And how many young women were in the room when you had those numerous encounters?
Did he ever introduce you to anyone that you had sexual relations with, sir? Yeah. It just happens all the time. When you break down syntactically what he has said about the virus, he's doing a terrible job. And of course, on their side, the Democrats and the press do a very bad job holding him to accountability, in part because they're so bad at being concrete and specific themselves.
Exactly. And but you know, that's the advantage of the Lincoln Project. Let me just stop you here.
Yeah.
What I saw happen with, what's her name, Ghislaine, whatever.
Yeah, that's right.
I have trouble.
An unexpected benefit. We've all learned how to pronounce a name we've never seen before. Ghislaine is G-H-I-S-L-A-I-N-E is pronounced for some reason, Ghislaine.
Ghislaine. Okay. So what I'm thinking is, as I heard that, and you were absolutely right, there was no follow-up. But the fact that he was so verbose in his response. I mean, let's be honest here. This was not a pithy response. Yes, we've met. No. He went on and on to talk about the numerous times, and she's a very nice person, and all that stuff. And I just saw the Lincoln Project being able to take exactly that response and doing the split screen and doing exactly what the numerous times might in fact include. And so while I'm angry at the media, while I'm angry at the Democratic Party for not knowing how to hold them accountable, for writing the right headlines in the New York Times, at least I see that there is going to be one group that knows how to be incredibly lethal. They know how to pull out their stiletto, and they know how to use these lines in a very effective way. How pathetic that they're not my party. How pathetic they're not journalists.
One wonders what party they'll be in if we do win this, and how the political landscape will be cordoned off and boundaried when all this is over. But yes, we could learn an awful lot from them. And again, there was an interesting piece in the Times yesterday about authoritarianism and the psychology and language of authoritarianism. And it made a point that we're all familiar with, which is that conservatives speak more simply than Democrats do. And in part, according to many studies, it's because they're not as smart. The people who speak in longer, more complex sentences usually are smarter. And there's no question that as conservatism has dumbed itself down over the years. I had the great, great privilege of debating William F. Buckley Jr. a number of times. He was someone from whom I learned a lot and whom I, in many ways, admired. When you think of what a long fall it is from Bill Buckley to Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson, if you want to think about the face of conservatism, it's just awful. But we have to learn a number of things from them, and one of which is, and what any person needs to do, any writer, any analyst, to distill down to the simplest what you want to get across. For instance, the Trump secret police, who have been sent into Portland and now Chicago and who knows where else, are not being sent in to stop looters. They're being sent in to antagonize and arrest protesters. This is not about looters, it's about protesters. This is about the criminalization of nonviolent free speech in America, which is fascistic. The Chuck Schumers and Pelosi's and all the people who have the microphone in our party have to realize that like the right, they have to make sure that some basic fundamental points are made again and again. Trump's been caught in 20,000 lies. If Barack Obama had been caught in 20 lies, every American would know that number. Okay, they would have made the point across. the fact that the president is provably the greatest proven liar in the history of American public life is something we would understand. And there would have been many CNN specials about what it means to have a national leader who's incapable of telling the truth. And we would have studied it and talked about it and brought it out. Everybody would know that having the greatest liar ever as president is a real problem. And of course, COVID is giving us, you know, we're dying for it now by the thousands every week.
So, you know how we have the debt clock? And I'm thinking about numbers that I'm thinking about. So right now, 8 minutes and 46 seconds. What does that mean? George Floyd. All I have to do is say 8 minutes and 46 seconds and everybody kind of knows it was the video of George Floyd. We have never created a number for Trump, whether it's the number of lies. I mean, the simplicity of the message is exactly right, because I think there is a simplicity of the message. And I think I've told you this story before when I ran for Congress. I said I was very jealous of the Republican Party because their entire agenda could fit on a bumper sticker. I said that their entire agenda is no. No taxes, no regulation, no health care, no whatever the no is. I said, and you know what's beautiful about no? It doesn't need explanation, Bill. No ends the conversation. It is a complete sentence and a complete thought. As soon as you say yes to some unemployment benefits, yes to some health care, yes to some regulation, guess what? It means you have to keep going. You can't just say yes. And that's part of the problem. But we have forgotten to remind the American people that you don't build a world, a life, a family, a job around no. You build one around yes. Yes, I love you. Yes, I'll marry you. Yes, I'll take this job. Yes, I'll buy this house. And they ain't easy yeses. And they're not just a word. They're fleshed out. But we are so afraid of what we are. We don't want to say what we are, and we're so jealous of their no.
And we've also, when the Republicans were building think tanks in the 1970s and 80s, Hoover, Heritage, American Enterprise, Cato, the Democrats were simply marrying their celebrity pollsters. The Republicans, to their credit, in those decades, spent an enormous amount of their capital on the development of ideology and content. And the Democrats began their still endless search for the perfect meme slogan. The problem is that simple memes and slogans work better for them than for us, just as you're saying. Right. That if you're the party of progress, in the Democratic Party, with all its warts and blemishes, was once the tribune of working people and the disadvantaged and the vulnerable in this society. It once, for all its faults, was that. And it's struggling to become that again through the changes of the last few years. But if you are that party, if you're the party of progress, that means you're the party of new ideas. And new ideas, by their very nature, require some explanation.
Thank you.
And it's more than 30 seconds. It's more than a meme. It's even more than 1 minute. Maybe it's 2 minutes. And you have to spend as much time explaining the actual substance of the idea as you spend searching for a catchy slogan. I've often written, policy precedes message. First you figure out what you believe and then how to tell people about it. And the Democrats' problems are twofold. One, they're mortgaged to big money. There is mortgage to big money, nearly as mortgaged as the Republicans. There's a palpable difference, but it's not near enough. And the second is the stuff you buy with that money is 30-second ads and memes and social media. And we spend our time not doing what progressive movements have done through our history. And I just stop for 1 second here and just say, if you think of the women's movement, I was the political director of the nuclear freeze movement. We didn't have a slogan. We had a proposal, which was a bilateral freeze, a bilateral verifiable freeze on the research, development, production, and deployment of nuclear weapons. And it caught on. You can't put that on a bumper sticker. We didn't have a different slogan for every micro group. Micro-targeting is for reactionaries. Slogans are for reactionaries. Democrats, we had the same message in Dakota as we had in Carolina, as we had in Greenwich Village, as we had in San Francisco. Because progressive change means bringing the country together and creating a momentum for real systemic change. So the people we take the money from don't want us to do it, and the things we spend the money on are almost impossible. Every real change has come from people walking door to door, grassroots, face to face, as both Mahatma Gandhi and Saul Alinsky said in their different languages. There's a chemical reaction that happens person to person. There's an opportunity in a real exchange of ideas, which is indispensable to progress, indispensable. There's good news. There's all kinds of stuff out there on the left where people are starting to do this again, and I'm hopeful for it. But the people at the top of our party have to understand, no, you don't need a white paper. Hillary Clinton had plenty of white papers, but she didn't take clear positions and she didn't explain them well. And the biggest problem is that a lot of the time she didn't really mean it and people could tell.
And you're sort of looking at the 2020 platform, and I know we want to get there, but I want to go back to something that you said, because we haven't really touched on what's happening with the military face or the people wearing camouflage or the people being thrown into unmarked vehicles in places like Portland and now perhaps Chicago and then maybe Kansas City and wherever there's a Democratic mayor is where they're going to show up, I'm sure, because this is really not about security and safety. It is really about fomenting rebellion. You talked about the fact that you did not like the term defund the police. You like the term demilitarize.
Yes.
Now more than ever, I think about demilitarize as I'm watching what Donald Trump is doing in Portland, because he is militarizing. And now the problem is that you're getting this sort of blending of look. You know, if you militarize the police, they kind of look like soldiers. Now Donald Trump is sending in people in fatigues that are, in fact, maybe, you know, people that have been working the border or have some kind of a military background or a special ops. And you're beginning to see this really frightening blend. And instead of having said defund, we said demilitarize. It would not just apply to the police, but it would apply to what's happening right now in places like Portland. And it would be so thematic, and it's not what we want or what we believe.
Again, by the way, when people say defund the police, but then, well, that's not really what we mean, that's not helpful. And secondly, we can spend more money. I'm not sure. I'll just take, when I was controller of the state of Connecticut, preparing to run for governor, I invited a whole set of social service people, child welfare people, addiction services people, people working in the parole system and probation. And I had them all from Greater Hartford. I had them all in my office. And I learned lots of things that day. But the main thing I learned was that they didn't know each other. That I was introducing people who worked in the same, and they were just working on different aspects of the same problem, unemployment, toxic families, parole. It's all a holistic question. And I realized then that the most important thing, if I got the job, would be to create a new management structure in which people really were able to coordinate what they were doing in these ways. When I think about the question about defunding the police, again, if you could just be more specific, I want to spend less money on violence-prone policing than I spend on community policing and also social outreach and social service support.
Right.
I don't know that they should be in two different departments. I don't know the answer to that. I know they have to be in some kind of mechanism where they actually work together. It may be that a lot of people who don't come from the police culture come from other institutions and into a single unit. And maybe they start to have to talk to each other. Certainly they get to
Beautiful.
Work with each other. These
Beautiful.
Are all things we have to just stop and ask, what do we want here? What will work here? And not let the slogan get ahead of the policy. Policy precedes message. First, figure out what you think, then how to tell people about it.
You know, so I had a county commissioner from Harris County on yesterday. And one of the things that's so interesting is 46% of Harris County's budget goes to law enforcement.
Yeah.
46%. And the reason I bring that up is that there was just a vote in the U.S. Senate about reducing the Pentagon's budget by 10%. What is fascinating is to look at the Democrats that voted for it and the Democrats that voted against it. My two Democrats, by the way, Gina Shaheen and Maggie Hassan, voted against reducing the Pentagon budget by 10%. But it wasn't just about reducing the budget by 10%. It was about redirecting the dollars. So it wasn't like we're just taking the dollars and saying, eek, we don't need you. Of course, they don't even know how much money they have. And the Pentagon will be even honest about that because they're swirling in cash. They have so many different accounting systems, they don't even know where the cash is going. But more importantly, they also said, if this is going to be reduced by 10%, this is the direction in which they go. And even when you read the military's report themselves, they understand what national security is. And a lot of their concerns are about exactly where those dollars would be going, Bill. That's the irony
yes.
here. They understand climate change. They understand race relations. They understand poverty because in part they understand what will ultimately bring about sort of the instability that they're going to eventually have to respond to.
Let me just say, I believe in democracy. I believe in democracy more than I believe in anything. And I believe that the democratization of our economy and the true democratization of our alleged democracy, of our partial democracy, would be the answer to so many of our problems. Without it, we won't really probably answer any of them. Having said that, If I had to choose between a Republican president in today's Republican Party with a veto-proof majority in the Senate and the House and a military dictatorship, I would still choose the former, but I would have no doubt that the latter would produce more enlightened policies for just the reasons you've said. And I would say about the military and that amendment, I would have been nervous about voting for that amendment. I'd voted for it, but I'd have been nervous about it. And again, the reason is we haven't had the nerve to stand up and say, okay, so for 40 years, America was the policeman of the world. And maybe we had to be. We didn't do it. We did a very mixed job on that. But we were the policeman of the world. But the world needs a policeman. And nobody else had the money or the aptitude or the bent to do it. But now all we do with this unilateral military interventionism is foster hatred and inequality and most of all corruption all over the world. We are not the ambassadors of democracy. We are the purveyors of corruption. And the biggest thing we've learned in the last 20 years, if we're paying attention, is one, these huge armies don't really make us safe. We're on the wrong side of an asymmetrical equation.
Right.
The threats we have can't be cured by the armies we have. And so that's number one. And number two, there must be a multilateral mechanism for the resolution of human conflict. If you don't want it to be the United Nations, propose another one. But I say the answer is not to destroy, but to fix it. The United Nations is broken in so many ways. So fix it. Our safety does not lie in the force of arms. It lies in the rule of law. And so we have to obey the rule of law, and we have to create, whether it's the International Criminal Court or the United Nations, we have to strengthen those institutions, WHO, for the present moment. And that's where our safety lies. And so I believe that especially after the semi-isolationist nutball Trump has actually done us one favor, he has softened the ground for the discussion of not just forever wars, but the wars we get into that we don't know are going to be forever wars. And also the very idea that we have both the right and the need to be intervening unilaterally and militarily across the world to solve its problems. We need to strengthen multilateral institutions. The United Nations was our idea. It was born in San Francisco. Right. American politicians did the draft. And we just have to get, you know, we have to be willing to defend those things as well. But to get up right now and say, listen, the money they're spending on the military didn't make you safe. I want to make you safer. Exactly. I know that's my first job. Exactly. And here's how we do it. Democrats have to get there.
They have to say that. I mean, what I'm listening is I'm listening to you talk about the UN, and there has to be a place where we can sort of get together and talk, and what you learned when you were the controller, that these people didn't even know each other. And I want to start screaming, going, relationships matter. Leadership matters. Relationships matter. We need these pieces
and
more than ever.
And institutions to foster those relationships rather than
we only have a few minutes left, and maybe this is for the next time. This book by Larry Tyab, Demagogue, about Joe McCarthy. And it turned out that ultimately the only institution, he'd attacked every institution, the State Department, senators, you name it, but the only institution that ultimately was able to stand up to Joe McCarthy was the military. And eventually, even though in the beginning, the military played with him and sort of let him do his thing, they began to realize that he was ultimately going to sort of cut them off at the knees. And then you see the hearings at the end of 1954, and it's the Army versus McCarthy. Okay?
And
so as I'm watching what happened.
They've made progress since then.
Right, right. But I'm watching what's going on now, and I'm almost afraid that once again, we're in a similar situation, which is the only thing that may end up standing up against Donald Trump, maybe the U.S. military.
Well, first of all, we're like any pathetic Latin American democracy, which is dependent upon the goodwill of its generals to endure. We are very much there right now. It's not paranoid. It's not conspiratorial. Mm-hmm. That's where we are. Anyone who thinks that Donald Trump wouldn't do worse than he's already done if given the chance has slept through the last 4 years.
Yeah.
And so we absolutely know that. We know that for sure.
And let me just say one thing. And the reason why they won't choose Donald Trump to support is that one of the things that we do know is this is the one place where there is a significant percentage of African Americans and Hispanics, because it's been a voluntary military, because of it, it is the one place where you actually see a very diverse America and a very brown America. It's in the U.S. military.
And I think
the generals know that too. And Donald Trump is actually undermining the people that they work with and they care for on a daily basis. So I think Trump doesn't quite get it, that the generals are looking at him and then they're looking at the people that they are there to sort of work with and protect. He's made the wrong choice.
I just want to make one other point, and that is often we reach the end of these interviews and we haven't gotten to climate change. And it's a tribute to how much of the intellectual bandwidth of the United States of America is eaten up by our need to obsess over Trump, over COVID, and over the Trump-COVID economic crisis.
Yes.
And if you gave the military, again, I'm for civilian rule. But if you actually gave the military control over climate policy, they would go much further than Obama went, let alone Trump, okay? So we just have to, with methane now leaching out of our ocean beds, as you posted today on Facebook, with all this happening, we have to. We may be at the tipping point. If not, we're within a few years of it. This is so much bigger than COVID. We're already so far down the line. You know, the two great crises in America remain climate change and corruption. We have to carve out space in our debate to discuss those two topics.
And I need to let you go, Bill Curry. I love having you on every 2 weeks. And as you were talking about climate change, I had literally just posted the story. I care about it too, but I feel like it's one of 12 and it should be six of 12. And yet because of Donald Trump, because of the media, because of what he's doing, he is a distraction. And it's a distraction to some of the most important issues we must confront because they are happening now. Bill Curry joins us every other week. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll schmooze on Monday. Thank you.
You've been-